This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark Kermode in for his film review, and he's brought me a coffee.
You see, you have to earn it. You don't know what it is. It's a symbolic coffee. It's the coffee that says, OK, that's all right. I'm OK, you're OK.
But that's why it tastes so good.
It does, yeah. It was years before I became Mayo's tea boy. I'm not entirely sure how it happened either. I'm not entirely sure how it happened that I don't think in the entire time that we've known each other, he's ever bought me a coffee.
I would never have wanted one outside of that. And, you know, I'm also not, you know, I'm not your Mayo methadone. When he's not here, it's obviously a different effect. So I thought I'd just bring you some sweeties to go
with. Oh, you got sweeties?
Yeah, I thought I'd bring some Revels because they're like you. You dip in, you never know what you're going to get.
Thank you.
You know,
but the Revels are there. They're the ones that they're some of them like orange on the inside, aren't they?
Yes. I love that. I don't do mainstream chocolate.
Well, thank you for the thought.
Okay. Well, here, I've got...
It's kind, but yet somehow horrible.
I've got jelly beans.
Oh, yeah, jelly. I'll swap you the rest.
Okay. I'll have those, you have those.
Yeah. Other sweets are available.
Right, well, listen, this week we're going to talk about Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging, amongst others. We've got Lou Reed's new film. We've got Before the Rains. We've got The Dark Knight. But we'll start, of course, with the UK Top 10. And if you want to watch this as well as listen, bbc.co.uk and go to the 5 Live website. And I felt like an auntie who'd invited somebody around and forgot to clean. I didn't know you could watch it. In the place, I just put my sandwich wrapper under the desk and stuff. It's a mess. I'm embarrassed. Okay, top 10, Donkey Punch at 10.
Which you've had some emails about, apparently.
We have emails just about every single film in that top 10.
See, I think Donkey Punch is interesting for its first movement. I mean, it is basically a very, very low budget British horror movie about a bunch of girls who meet up with a bunch of guys whilst on holiday. The difference with all those films like the Eli Roth movies is that it's the British guys who turn out to be the source of the horror. And for its first movement, before things turn into a full-on horror movie, it's got this very sweaty, sort of sensual, edgy feeling about it. It does then descend into horror movie cliche, and the moment in which Jamie Winston comes storming out of a room with a running outboard motor, which she's using as her weapon of choice, did, you know, raise laughter in the screening that I was at. But, you know, there's 40 minutes of good stuff in it, and I think that the guy who directed Ollie, I think he has got talent, and I think we will see better from him in the future. It's interesting, there was a piece in Time Out in which he interviewed Nick Rogue about Nick Rogue's new movie Puffball, and they sort of, the two filmmakers, you know, one young one, well, you know, one been around for a lot longer, sort of seemed to find a lot of ground in common. So I think there's stuff in there. I don't think it's a brilliant movie, but I think it's certainly better than some reviews have suggested.
Jonathan Guilford saw it on Saturday and said he rather enjoyed its blend of proper X-rated sex and violence with assured British filmmaking. He said, and maybe you'd agree with him, he particularly liked the fact that it was a Brit flick with no trace of Danny Dyer, Nick Love, or any core blimey cockerney geezerisms. And in fact, that annoyed the hell out of the Daily Mail.
But I have to tell you something. I know we're going to talk about this later on, but of course I went to see The Dark Knight last week, and I saw it in the Odeon in Leicester Square, a huge big cinema. And at the very beginning of the screening, somebody came forward and said, you know, welcome to this special screening of The Dark Knight. And beforehand, we're going to show you the trailer of the new Guy Ritchie movie. And you could hear this sound. And went, oh no. And then there was like 3 or 4 minutes of blokes going, all right, yeah, go blimey, yeah, stick the reddies in a boot and do a runner, he's got a geezer. And then you really half expected Danny Dyer to go, oh, Danny Dyer, oh. And you know, and then it stopped, and there was this kind of, thank heaven that's over, now we got The Dark Knight. But it was really funny, but even before the new Guy Ritchie, and of course they describe it in the trailer as from the director of Lockstock and the director of Snatch. They don't say from the director of Revolver and from the director of that Madonna film that nearly killed her career stone dead, but was probably somehow involved in the recent tabloid scandal. It was anyway,
lovely.
Poor old Guy Ritchie.
Let's move on to number 9. We'll bash him a bit later if we
can. Yes.
I'm up for that. The Forbidden Kingdom.
You know, it's the problem with The Forbidden Kingdom is that when you get those two talents together, when you get Jet Li and Jackie Chan together, you kind of expect more than what is essentially a rather anodyne, Americanized version of a Chinese story. Interesting solely at the moment, I think, because there's so much monkey going around at the moment. You know, there's the monkey Olympics film, there's the monkey the opera, and of course there is some monkey in The Forbidden Planet. It's like you cannot turn left without bumping into monkey at the moment. But The Forbidden Kingdom isn't anything like as good as it ought to be.
What's the greatest monkey movie then? What's the greatest movie featuring a monkey? Got to be 80s.
No, not a monkey. Monkey. Not a monkey. The Monkey King. Monkey. You know, as in monkey.
Yes.
Yeah, but you said featuring a monkey.
Yeah, but I thought I'd move it on a bit.
Oh, I see. For greatest movie featuring a monkey. Okay, fine. So I'll tell you an interesting story about movies featuring ape. Well, they're not monkeys, they're apes. 2001, right? In the year that 2001 came out, this is interesting. The year that 2001 came out, Planet of the Apes got a makeup Oscar. Yeah. And 2001 didn't. And the reason that is generally credited for 2001 not being up for it is that the people didn't realise that they were men in suits. Because in Planet of the Apes, obviously it's guys, it's Roddy McDowell, of course it's guys in suits. But the guy, because it's a French guy, the main ape in the beginning of 2001, it's a very famous French mime artist. And apparently the people, they thought that the Oscar voters just simply thought they were just very well-trained apes.
But that's as baffling as some of the sign-ins on the emails we're getting, which we'll come to in a second. But let's get through this. At 8 Wanted.
I like the way you say, let's get through this. Like it's something we have to some kind of Stygian gloom.
No, not at all. I love it.
The pun we've made every week with Wanted is, you know, unwanted. It's nice to see James McAvoy fronting a big action movie. It's a shame that it's such a vacuous, empty thing. It is a little bit of The Matrix and a little bit of, you know, Fast and Furious, and it's got incredible gun fetishism in it, which I see there was a thing in the paper today that Lord Attenborough was complaining about, you know, movies inspiring violence in the real world, which I don't think actually is the case at all. Mm. But you do look at a movie like Wanted, and you do think this gun fetishism, I don't think it's inspiring violence in the real world. I just think it's a bit petty, really. You thought I was going to keep talking while you opened the bag of Rebels.
I was looking for a moment just to pile into the Rebels. Are you going to take those home with you?
I am,
Jelly
yeah.
Babies. Okay.
Yeah. I can't eat and review at the same time.
This one sounds just for me horrendous. The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian at 7.
Why does it sound horrible?
It's just not my type of movie. Anything that chronicles anything or enters fairy tale land, it just puts me off going. I'd love to.
You don't do fairy tales at all.
I just never enjoy them. I didn't enjoy Lord of the Rings. I would like to have one suggested to me that I could go to and love, because I'm very open to cinema. I don't have any sort of I only go and see this one type of film attitude.
Have you seen Secret Garden?
No.
Seen Little Princess?
Yeah.
Mm. No? Seen Princess Bride?
See, I love the book, hate the film. Love the book. It's in my top
you
three.
You hate the film with the Princess Bride?
I did the book before the film.
And you don't like The Lord of the Rings?
It's just camp, the film. It's got a camp quality to it, but
okay, we are going to have a big falling out about this. So what about things
just
like...
Take the coffee back.
What about things like... No, you've sullied it now. What about things like Mary Poppins?
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, okay,
yeah,
it's fine. So you've got a borderline fairy tale thing. Mary Poppins is a fairy tale.
Okay.
Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, love. I suppose the modern day.
So what you mean is you don't like modern day screen. So what you're objecting to is the CGI stuff.
Yeah, this is a little bit like Luke Skywalker picking up a lightsaber and not knowing how to turn it on. I'm not an expert on it. I just know that it turns me off. I needed the Yoda advice.
Okay, so. Well, for the Yoda advice for everybody else is... I mean, I funnily enough, when The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe came out, the first one, I sort of complained that it was like Lord of the Rings light. Actually, I think that lightness was part of its virtue. Prince Caspian's not bad. It's a bit over. Long, and it does lack some of the innocent simplicity of the first one, because the fact of the matter is that did you read the Narnia books? Mm-hmm. The story does come and go a little bit.
Yes.
There are some of the books are very strong and some of them aren't quite so strong, and I think they've got one more left in them, and that's fine. But I took my kids to see it and they enjoyed it very, very much, and even though I thought it was too long, they were with it all the way through, and it's good, clean entertainment.
Journey to the Center. C-E-N-T-E-R.
Yeah, because it's American.
Of the Earth. The center of the Earth.
Although at one point they do produce a copy of the book, and the book is the English edition, and it says The Century of the Earth. And it's if you go and see it in 3D. I think it's available in both flat screen and 3D, but you need to see it in 3D, because if you don't, if you're watching on the vodcast, you won't understand why people keep doing this. I mean, there's an awful lot of pointing. There's an awful lot of things falling towards the camera. There's one moment in which Brendan Fraser gets mouthwash and swirls it around in his mouth and then spits it out at the camera. And if you're watching in flat screen, it's kind of no point in doing all that stuff. But if you're watching in 3D, I saw it again with a bunch of school kids and they enjoyed it very much. I mean, it's obviously, there's nothing particularly original about it, but the 3D is done quite efficiently. And I thought it was jolly good fun, if completely forgettable.
Dear Hinge and Bracket, this comes from Nick in New Jersey, who says that I'm not quite sure what is annoying Mark about the spelling of Journey to the Centre of the Earth.
It's not annoying me. I'm saying
Let me finish.
I'm fine with it.
He says, since the original title of the book is French, obviously the words are translated into the local dialect.
Yeah, I'm not complaining about it. I've never complained about it. The person who complained about it was Mayo. I didn't have a problem with it.
That's why you're better off with me, you know.
But you can
be.
About
he
it.
May be there at the end of the night for the hug, but I'm the excitement.
Okay.
Okay. Number 5, Meet Dave.
Yeah. Or or don't. See, I mean, this. What is it? Eddie Murphy. I mean, of the fact is, of many of the recent Eddie Murphy films, this is the least obnoxious. Interestingly enough, in being the least obnoxious, it's also been the least successful. Mm. I mean, you look at some of the really, really horrible films he made recently, like Norbit, which took a whole bunch of money and was an absolutely morally reprehensible, vile, horrible film. And then you look at Meet Dave, which is just a not very well done comedy in which Eddie Murphy comes to Earth in a spacesuit which looks like Eddie Murphy. So he's inside Eddie Murphy and he's out. So there's more Eddie Murphy than you could possibly do. And it's just innocuous. And as a result of it, it hasn't actually done very well. In America, it's underperformed quite a lot. And it does suggest that when Eddie Murphy makes those really vile comedies like Norbit, he actually does have a handle on what the audience want. And I think that's really sad. I think that's a really sad indictment of the way things have gone with modern cinema. That if you make Norbit and make money, make more money than you make out of Meet Dave, which is just boring.
It would have made money still, though, in the States. It would have turned a profit.
Oh, yeah, no. But it's just in terms of, you know, how much. I mean, nothing loses money anymore. Mm. There is a point when because of what happened with videos and DVDs and ancillary sales, it basically became impossible for movies to, in the long run, lose money. And the watershed moment, as everybody knows, was Waterworld. Waterworld was a movie which, as it was coming up to coming out, the accountants were saying, there is not enough money in the world to put Waterworld into profit. And, of course, yes, there is. And yeah. After that, if Waterworld could turn a profit with terrible reviews, then, you know, everything would in the end make its money back.
Yeah, because when I see those films coming out with Eddie Murphy and someone who, you know, likes Trading Places and Coming to America and see
he was great once.
But see, he was absolutely, but to see that, and obviously, of course, a wonderful stand-up amongst the best there's ever been. But
he was a bigot, unfortunately.
When I see those, moving on from that, just the particular point, when I see these Norbits and stuff come out and go to DVD, I think from a British perspective, is he washed out? Is he just a one-trick pony when it comes to films? But he's probably
I think he's taking the money. Okay, and, you know, if not taking the responsibilities that perhaps he should be taking.
Let's move up market now. Kung Fu Panda is the fourth highest-grossing movie.
Does
the
what
UK
it
box
says
office.
On the tin. It's a panda. He does kung fu. It's Kung Fu Panda. Have you seen it?
Do you know what? I didn't want to say this in case our burgeoning friendship ended right now. I want to go and see it. Is that wrong?
No. What's wrong with going to see Kung Fu Panda?
I'll go see it during the day.
No, it's perfectly fine. And in fact, it's good kids' holiday entertainment. It's completely innocuous. I think the BBFC rating says, you know, contains mild panda hitting, and that's just about it. But it's perfectly fine. It's, again, it's nothing to write home about, but it's perfectly fine.
I love it. Let's do the top three. Hancock, Will Smith.
You know, one half of an interesting movie and one half of a very uninteresting movie, and a classic case, and again, this will relate to what we're going to say about The Dark Knight. A classic case of, if you're spending that much money, halfway through, the producers just go, OK, let's stop being adventurous and let's just make Transformers. Mm. So you get the first half of the movie is about a down-and-out bum who's a superhero, and the second half of the movie is just action heroes hitting each other, because people just feel that if you're going to spend that kind of money, you've got to, in inverted commas, please the crowd. And Hancock's a perfect example of half a film. It's half a film and then it's just, you know, it's just the money on screen, and I think it's very disappointing.
Where do you place Will Smith in that theory in terms of people's love affair with him? Can he carry a bad movie? Is he at that love for him?
He's one of the very few people who can still open a film on the basis of it being him, even if it doesn't have great reviews. I mean, if it's him, and particularly if it's a genre movie, I mean, you look at I Am Legend, for example, which didn't get great reviews at all, but on the basis of it being a Will Smith movie, I mean, he is still one of the very few actors whose name above the marquee, above the name, actually means something.
And I don't want to ramble on about it, but just very quickly, I Am Legend, stinker.
Well,
I thought it was a stinker.
Yeah, have you seen it on DVD?
In the cinema.
If you get the DVD, I mean, there are a lot of things wrong with that film, not least of which is the Bob Marley stuff, and it is all over the place. No, I agree. I'm not defending that. But if you get it on DVD, there is the original ending, which is a lot better and a lot darker and a lot more interesting. But it was a long and tedious film. There was, again, half of a good film was in there, and then the other half of it was just nonsense.
Then maybe they do that in Hollywood meetings. We've got half a good film. Get me his email number.
No, they don't do that. They go, we've got Will Smith. What's the opening date? And then someone goes, script? No, don't worry, we'll do it in post.
We'll catch up on some texts and emails in just a second, but let's do a top two then. Wall-E.
which I like. I mean, it's obviously very, very derivative of Silent Running, which is one of my favourite films of all time. Have you seen that, Silent Running, 1970s science fiction movie?
No. I would love to lie, but I don't think I'd get away with that.
No, no, that is an absolutely wonderful film, and WALL-E is very much like that. I think the first half an hour of WALL-E is just terrific, when it's just the little robot alone on Earth cleaning up and watching Hello Dolly on the old VHS, which is absolutely wonderful. Later on, when he goes out into outer space, it kind of downshifts a little bit, but I think it needs to do that in order to, you know, to satisfy the kids' audience. I really liked it. I mean, it's not completely flawless, but it is very, very impressive. It's a really good piece of work by Pixar. And as always with Pixar movies, there's a short supporting film, which is just hilarious. It's a really, really funny opening 4-minute little featurette, and it's just terrific. So, you know, if you haven't seen that yet, it's definitely one to go and see over the holiday season.
Jeff from Curb Your Enthusiasm's the voice or in it or something. I'm going to go and see it. My friend told me yesterday.
Never seen Curb Your Enthusiasm TV programme.
It's the only thing I'd change about you. But Nider O'Leary has said, I don't know if it was the hype or the publicity, but I ended up finding WALL-E a little disappointing. It's well made and it looks beautiful, as distinct from impressive.
Yeah, no, that's right. It does look beautiful. And it's interesting that they got Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, in to come and look at the computer graphics and say, if you were shooting this with a camera, this is what you'd do. I mean, it does look beautiful. That's completely correct.
But he then says, in the same sentence, it's too twee for its own good. The story with the humans is too perfunctory to follow through on his promise. It's quite sweetly done, but if this is a contender for best film of the year, then it's been a pretty bad year.
Well, I disagree. I think that when you're in a year in which any animation film looks like a contender for best film at this point in the year, that's a very good year for animation. And I mean, we've also, in recent years, we've seen Persepolis recently. There's this fantastic thing coming out with Waltz with Bashir, which was at the Cannes Film Festival. I think animation's never been stronger. I think it's, you know, the emergent genre, and I think it's terrific that any animated film should be up for best film.
Number one, Mamma Mia.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Don't say it like that. Have you not?
No.
Are you going to go and see it?
No.
Okay. Well, this has been an ongoing thing here, but I thought it was one of the very few examples of a film which was so bad it was brilliant. And the first,
like Glitter.
No, not like Glitter. Glitter's just not good.
I don't know. That's bad enough, I think, to be brilliant.
No, but I didn't enjoy Glitter. Did you enjoy Glitter?
Did you go
and see Glitter?
No, I didn't. It was on the telly. It was on ITV 48 or something.
Oh, and you couldn't turn it off?
And it was an afternoon, and I was in a house full of girls.
So you were forced to watch it.
And they watched it, and I went, oh. And then I ended up saying, and I did. I couldn't agree more. If something's that bad, it can be brilliant. The worst type of film to go and see is something that's just slightly below average. That's the ones I can't
Well, Mamma Mia isn't slightly below average. Mamma Mia is so far down the pit of terribleness that actually about halfway through, your brain does a kind of complete inversion. And it's like you pass through a warp in the time-space continuum. You come out where bad is good, and suddenly Pierce Brosnan he really can't sing. And a couple of people since I reviewed it said that they went to see it thinking that I was exaggerating about how much Pierce Brosnan can't sing. And lordy, 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 Miss Claudie, when he opened his mouth and started singing, you sort of put, you don't know whether to put your hands over your ears or your eyes, because you're not sure whether looking at him or hearing him do it is worse. It's brilliant.
We've got Anne at Bamborough, who says, Dear Frankenstein and the Creature, after the odd doctor's fantastical review of Mamma Mia, my wife and I went to see the film at a tiny cinema in Penrith last Saturday night. A packed screening, 94 people watched, enthralled at the stuff happening in screen, and the salt in our ears that you're quite right, does turn you pink. Ups become downs, black becomes white, and for the first time ever in the cinema, I applauded at the end.
Very
with
good.
Everyone in the cinema.
Excellent.
He says, fantastic. I might go again.
You really should. It is. I wouldn't usually recommend something that's so. But in this case, I would say you need to see Mamma Mia. You need to see it in the cinema because it's going to be one of those things in years to come. People go, did you see Mamma Mia? And we say, yeah, I saw it on television. No. Seeing it on television is not the right thing. You have to be there in the cinema on a Friday night with people going,
you know. I might have to do it. Trudy in Wiltshire's texted in. Saw Mark play at Larmatree.
Yeah, the Larmatree Festival.
Yeah, he's much better looking in real life, and his band was fabulous.
Much better looking in real life
in
than
real
what?
Life than on that the web screening that people can watch now online. Agree about I Am Legend DVD, the alternative ending, much better. We call it the British ending in our house because it takes a bit of thinking. On that. I'm with the Irish fella, comes an email, thanks. I always feel great when I get referred to as that. Josh Armitage says, I couldn't agree more on the not enjoying fairy tales fronts as films. Rubbish the lot of them. I'm being educated, I think, more, Josh. Wouldn't have said Mary Poppins was a fairy tale film, if you get what I mean. So I'm
Hang on, sorry. Mary Poppins, not a fairy tale.
Yeah, but I kind of...
Hard-hitting social realist documentary.
Absolutely, you just need to look for the hidden message. No.
You know, there are hidden messages in it.
They are fine.
Okay, right, proof, right? Firstly, the mother is a suffragette, okay? So there's all that political stuff. No, there is. The mother is a suffragette, fine, at the very beginning. The father goes out to the bank, goes to work, ignores his children, but during the course of the movie realises that his children are more important to him than money is, and his wife realises that there is more to him than the bloke who goes out. And, I mean, of course, it's all about... And alternative family construction, that where they walk up to the top of the town and you get Mary Poppins and the chimney sweep and the two children, okay? The witch, the chimney sweep, and the two kids. Alternative Sorry, I have been... And I'm not kidding. I have been to academic papers presented on Mary Poppins, literally academic papers, and one fantastic one, which was given at the University of Southampton, in which a fantastically intelligent Australian man stood up and did this beautiful paper about Mary Poppins, spoiled only by the fact that he burst into tears in the middle of it because he was so overcome by the glory of Mary Poppins.
Well, I just needed a clarification. I've got them all in the one folder now. I would have had them separated. Another email from Peter... Peter Welshman. It says, "Oh yes," is the subject. "I'm only signed up to two podcasts, Fight and Talk and Pinky and Perky's film reviews." So there you go. Thanks for that,
There's
Pete.
One here from... It just says Sid from New Delhi, which said, "It looked as if Mark was going to slap Colin and walked out when Colin said he didn't like The Princess Bride."
Yeah. The book is in my top three of all time. So when you talk about, "Do I like The Princess Bride?" I love The Princess Bride. Yeah? Just watch the film... right after finishing the book and kind of went, it wasn't terrible. But anyway, dear Colin and Mark, I know my place. Mark and Colin, please, if you're putting it in. And I'll always, if you do these things, you know, like Frankenstein the creature, I'm always going to assume the first one is Mark as well when they're sent in. So M before C, except after Mayo. Anyway, referring back to your earlier conversation with monkeys and bad Brit horror, may I suggest the perfect confluence of the two, Straight Heads with Danny Dyer, a really bad Straw Dogs ripoff.
It's a terrible, terrible film. And that was the last time we saw Gillian Anderson before she turned up in the new X-Files movie.
I asked people earlier to send in texts and emails about sequels being better than the original.
Yeah.
And obviously you'll have your own point
of
view.
Story 2.
But Dark Knight slightly better than Batman Begins. That was the whole preface. Okay, this is a bit for later. But on that subject, dear Mark and Lard.
That's an old one, yes, exactly.
First time I made it. 28 weeks later, better than 28 days later. Aliens better than Alien.
Well, that's debatable. I think Aliens is generally held to be a more exciting movie, but obviously from a sort of design point of view, Alien is better.
Terminator 2 better than Terminator.
Yes, I do agree with that.
Wrath of Khan better than Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yes, I agree with that. Although none of them are as good as The Search for Spock.
Check this. Threequels. Revenge of the Sith better than Attack of the Clones.
It is.
Spider-Man 3 better than Spider-Man 2.
It is.
Cube Zero better than Cube 2 Hypercube.
I would agree.
I love all three, but I would agree.
Okay.
Fourquels better than threequels.
Go on.
Lethal Weapon 4 better than 3.
No,
okay. Hellraiser 4 better than 3.
Four
is the space station.
Yeah, no. 3 is better than 2, but 4 is not better than 3.
Okay. Dear Buttercup and Wesley, my wife is a straight-A student in Wendy Oxford. She loved Sex in the City. Dear Saint and Greavesy, my wife, PhD, MA, postgraduate diploma, saw Sex in the City and said it was all right. That's from Richard Neal, MA, BA. Dear Dr. Mayo and Dr. Kermode, this came in earlier in the week. I enjoyed Sex in the City. That's from Susie, MA, Honours, Oxon.
Yeah.
Double first class.
This is an ongoing thing when we were asking people. I said, it's not that nobody enjoys Sex and the City, it's just that no clever people enjoy it. And can I just say...
Creative people rather than clever.
No, I think I meant clever. I'm sorry. From Mark Goldie. And I'm sorry, Mark, I owe you an apology. I say, he says, Spider-Man 3 better than Spider-Man 2. Are you mad? No, I'm sorry. I was just simply mistaken and briefly flustered. The one with Dr. Octopus... which is the good one, is Spider-Man 2. Spider-Man 3 is rubbish, yes, and I fully apologise and thank you for correcting me, Mark Goldie. Yes, no, I'm not mad. I was just... had a head full of jelly babies.
And corrected life on the radio.
I'm very, very, very happy to be publicly corrected when I make a mistake. It's... an increasingly frequent occurrence. Shall we do The Dark Knight?
Yeah, because, and it's a hot potato. We've got a lot of texts and emails on it here. Okay. The Dark Knight.
Just, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, obviously the new Batman movie, which has already taken, well, whether or not it's gone past 250 million, up beyond 300 million, who knows, but it's taken a staggering amount of money already. Christopher Nolan, who directed, you know, Memento and The Prestige, and is a sort of proper filmmaker who basically reinvented the Batman franchise with Batman Begins. Now he returns with Dark Knight, which the title suggests that you're going to get sort of Bob Kane as filtered through Frank Miller. What you get is Christian Bale returning as Batman, Batman wanting to hang up his cloak and perhaps hand over the reins of power in the sort of in the scales of justice to a properly elected hero, being unable to do so for a number of reasons. One of them is that Gotham is in fact descending into lawlessness under the whip hand of the Joker, his longtime nemesis. And the Joker is creating chaos, and the Joker wants nothing more than for Batman to reveal himself. Indeed, goes so far as to say that if Batman does not reveal himself, he will take revenge upon the citizens of Gotham.
Tell them your name.
Brian.
Are you the real Batman?
No.
No?
No.
No. Then why do you dress up like him?
He's a symbol. We don't have to be afraid of scum like you.
Yeah.
You do, Brian. You really do. Huh? Yeah.
Oh, shh. So you think Batman's made Gotham a better place? Look at me.
Look at me!
You see, this is how crazy Batman's made Gotham. If you want order in Gotham, Batman must take off his mask and turn himself in. Oh, and every day he doesn't, people will die. Starting tonight. I'm a man of my word.
Well, loads of views coming in, but we need the doctors first.
Well, look, it is a game of many parts, and let's do them in order. Firstly, the Heath Ledger issue. I think Heath Ledger is very, very good. All the talk about, you know, an early Oscar nomination. I think if he's nominated, it has to be for supporting actor. I know some people are pushing for actor, but it is an ensemble cast. I mean, in fact, I don't think there's anybody on screen enough to justify an actor nomination. And interestingly enough, one of the things, and this has been said by some other people who texted in, one of the things that happens because of Heath Ledger's performance is that Christian Bale actually gets oddly sidelined. Yes. And I thought that although I thought he was terrific in the first movie, in the second one I did find him as Batman a little bit out of his depth, which I never expected. Part of the problem is the voice, which is, you know, has gone. I know.
What was that about?
Well, there is the suggestion, isn't there, that it's a larynxy effect in order to distinguish between, you know, that identity and the other identity. But I did definitely feel that it sat very awkwardly this time round.
It was too much.
Yeah, it was. It really was.
But is that a post-production thing?
Well, it has been tweaked in post-production, but the suggestion
it's
is...
too much.
I know. I thought that didn't work, and I thought that was a bit of a shame. And I like Christian Bale very much, but I did think that actually, as Batman, he wasn't as sure-footed as he had been in the past. The other things are, it's a movie about ideas, and it's extraordinary that anyone can spend millions and millions of dollars and make what is essentially an ideas movie. And the ideas are dark and light. The fact that the Joker is the other side of Batman, there's all this stuff about you complete me, you make the world more fun, you know, that which does not kill you makes you stranger, and you are the strangest, you know, creature around. And actually, now that has been explored an awful lot before in the graphic novels, and it's really put up there, you know, right in front of you on the screen in Chris Nolan's movie. And I think on the one hand, you absolutely have to admire the fact that it is a movie of ideas. I think the problem is that sometimes the ideas get in the way of the emotions. And I did find for an awful lot of the film, watching it, thinking, I admire this greatly. Why don't I love it more? And at one point, I thought it was that kind of, you know, the relationship thing about it's not you, it's me. You know, it's not the film. It's somehow I'm not up to the mark. But the more I think about it, the more I think it's probably both of us. I think that there is a problem in that it's slightly overladen. One of the things is that they try to introduce the Harvey Dent Two-Face character, and I think that that is one character too many. I mean, the weird thing is that all the things I think are wrong with it are things that I know that if you said them to the filmmaker, they'd say, no, but that's the whole point, because the Joker's aim is to demonstrate that that a good man can be turned bad, and that is something which happens through the Dent Two-Face character, and yet that character felt something like an add-on to me. There is also one too many moral problems that are set up in ways that look like set pieces. Now, without wishing to give away plot details, because this will only make sense if you've seen the film, when you get to the set piece about the ships, I thought, okay, fine, you need to take this out. I know for a fact that if you said it to the screenwriter, they'd say, no, that's the whole moral heart of the piece. And it was a perfect example of cut your lovies, kill your darlings, that's what they say. You know, the scene that you love the most, take it out. The film is too long, and there are entire strands of it that could be taken out, and I think the film would actually be stronger as a result of it. On the plus side, I think it's beautifully shot by Wally Pfister, who's a fantastic cinematographer who, and I say this every time, started out shooting straight-to-video erotic thrillers for Greg Dark, right? Alexander Gregory Hippolyte, and learned his trade there and has now gone on to be one of the most sought-after, you know, cinematographers in Hollywood, and good for him. The best performance in the film, by a mile, is Gary Oldman. I mean, he just is. It's understated, and it's a proper character, and you absolutely believe in him. And what I want, if anything, is... I want more of him, but it'd be lovely to see him get a nomination, because actually he's the guy who gets kind of overlooked in all of this. And I sat there thinking that there's so... I mean, I do think people should go and see it. I think that there is so much... The action sequences are very, very well constructed. The design is beautifully done. And I think its intentions are entirely in the right place, and its heart is entirely honourable. It is a film which doesn't give up the ghost of its ideas. And I've been complaining constantly about films which give up their ideas halfway through and just turn into people hitting each other. And it's odd, therefore, to find myself saying that the problem here is that there's so many ideas, or the ideas are so rammed, you know, down the audience's throat, that actually the point at which what you want is emotional engagement, I felt oddly detached. And this, I think, is the key thing for me. It's a strangely cool movie-going experience other than the action sequences. Yeah. And I didn't find that with Batman Begins. There were things wrong with Batman Begins, but lack of emotional involvement was not one of them.
You see, I just didn't get the whole "it's too long" thing. I never once looked at my watch.
Oh, okay, well, fine.
But I liked the two-face role. I thought, from the point of view of Aaron Eckhart, to play that role must have been wonderful, to do both sides of the coin. And also...
Although it's interesting, I mean, as some people have pointed out, it's an interesting piece of casting to cast Aaron Eckhart, because Aaron Eckhart always plays slimy, creepy characters.
Yeah.
And when you see him as the good side, when that's what I don't... I only believe him when he trips over into the bad side.
That first scene, when you first see him...
Yeah.
You think he's a creep. It's so funny, you go, oh, there's something wrong with him.
Yeah, he's clearly
straight away.
Creep. Exactly.
You know, even if you didn't know the story, you would.
Yeah.
There were some beautiful moments for me in terms of just individual scenes, rather than the greater, bigger picture of it, pardon the pun. The Joker... And the biggest pile of money I've ever seen, the film burning.
Yes.
Was just a wonderful couple of minutes.
Yes, but it's a set piece. It is a wonderful set piece, but it's a set piece.
Yeah. And while I was totally up for the movie, you make a great point about the thing in the ships. Because actually, the moral dilemma of the two ships, they do again, kind of anyway, where...
Oh, yes,
Batman
Yeah. Exactly. And that's why we say, when we're talking about this in this sort of strangely not finishing our sense of it, because we don't absolutely do not want to spoil it for anybody who's coming. I mean, I had the real privilege of being able to see it before I'd read reviews of it, which is a great thing. And if you, obviously, people are going to see it now. If you want to go and see it, you know, without reading some internet dissection of all the stuff behind it. It's good to be surprised. I didn't know anything about any of the makeup, and that was quite surprising to see some of that makeup. But I, you know, without spoiling it, I think... As I think we both agree with this, that there is one moral dilemma set piece too many.
And do you know what it is as well? And I think that's what cheapens that bit. And I actually think it's a fantastic movie. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm not big into my comics and my graphic novels, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And Batman Begins was a yardstick, and this goes further for its genre, if you ask me. But there was, you know, Saw...
Yes.
The voice. You have to... this is your dilemma.
Yeah, exactly. You thought that he... Christian
Bale
said
just a little
like
bit of that when Joker's on the phone and he's saying, you've got to pick this or that, you've got to do that or the other.
Okay.
Let's play a game. I
understand that. I mean, unfortunately, that's because the Saw character is effectively ripped off a character which has its, you know, has its ancestry in the Joker. So what you're looking at is retrospective ripping off, which is kind of slightly unfair. I mean, I understand what you mean, but it's like the comic books were there before Saw.
Yeah.
And I also want to make absolutely clear... I am not saying to anybody, don't go and see it. I mean, I think the fact that it's taken as much money as it has is perfectly fine, because, thank heaven, a film which is so ideas-laden has made that much money. The only thing I would say is it's a 12A certificate. And I said this again with Batman Begins. It's not for kids.
No.
It's not a young... I mean, the BBFC have said that it's fantasy violence and it doesn't dwell on the injury and pain, but there were a couple of sequences in it that I thought were quite nasty. I'm quite glad they were quite nasty because they were meant to be, but it's not a young kid's movie. Please take the 12A certificate seriously.
It absolutely, absolutely. Now, dear Simon or Colin and Mark, I'm in Hong Kong. Watch The Dark Knight. I feel the fundamental problem of the film is that it's a is that it is a Batman movie, but people went in wanting to see the Joker, yet it's actually really about Two-Face, so it works in those levels. And that's from Cano, who's pursuing countless
degrees.
But
that is an interesting point. You know, it's a Batman movie about the Joker, and then you have Two-Face. And funnily enough, if you compare that to what happened with the second Tim Burton movie, when suddenly the Penguin comes in, and there is this thing, hold on, Cat, Bat, you remember the poster for that was the Cat, the Bat, the Penguin. There is at the centre of this movie the absolutely, you know, the sort of Nietzschean relationship between Batman and the Joker, and you sort of feel that every minute that that's not at the centre, you're kind of watching the sideshow, and that's a problem for me.
Eric in Gothenburg says, "Dear Sapphire and Steel, I saw The Dark Knight yesterday and I'm still recovering from the experience. What a dark and intelligent blockbuster.
It is very dark.
Dear Streisand and Midler, I went to see The Dark Knight last night. I was amazed. My main thought when I left the cinema was, wow, it's a proper film."
Can I just say something on this? People have been using this thing about it's a crime movie. Can we get over this? It's a comic book movie. What's wrong with calling it that? There is a strange snobbery involved in people saying, okay, oh no, it's a proper movie now. Fine, it's a proper movie, it's a crime movie. Hey, no. You know, it's like horror movies are proper movies. Comic book movies are proper movies. We don't have to call it, we don't have to study. And it's like that thing, it's not a horror movie. Yes, it is. Yeah. You know, Exorcist is a horror movie. Batman is a comic book movie. It's not a bad thing. It's perfectly fine. But let's not pretend that we have to invent new genres for films which are any good in the genre they're in. It's a comic book movie.
Especially when they're getting closer than ever to the comic graphic novel.
There is some precedent in that comic books were originally called, you know, crime. You know, that's what
No need to change.
No need to do. No.
Lou Reed's Berlin.
Yes, we're jumping around in the order, so just lean behind me. Going to go Lou Reed's Berlin. So this is a live performance of Lou Reed's album Berlin, made in the mid-1970s, which, according to the press notes, was a commercial failure and generally regarded as one of the most depressing records ever made, and therefore he never performed it live for 33 years. And Julian Schnabel is the guy who made The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. You know, he's an artist, and I love Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and apparently he absolutely loved Berlin. So for various kind of complicated connections, he arranged that he would stage and film Lou Reed in New York playing Berlin in the same way that, for example, you know, Sparks recently did a tour in which on every night they played a different album. Did you know that? They played their entire back catalogue, album by album, one at a time.
Mogwai have been doing that as well.
Have they? Okay, fine. So everyone's doing it, so nothing new there. So what you basically get is Lou Reed performing Berlin, which is a fairly depressing album. It's a story about, you know, a woman that he knew whose life ended sort of very terribly, and according to the songs, awful things, you know, drugs, abusive relationships, children taken away. You know, I mean, it's not fun. It's that kind of standard Lou Reed and everything. And in between it, what we get is we get little sort of film interstitial stuff done by Julian Schnabel, in which we have Emmanuel Signe, who is effectively reenacting the sort of the central character who, you know, the whole album is about. And so there's this kind of Warhol-esque film of a beautiful woman wandering around looking a little bit wasted, and there's sort of burning out film stuff, and then there's the performance of the album, right? And then at the end of the album, after he's done the whole thing and it has all been fairly miserable, I think it's quite a good album, although with Lou Reed I can kind of take him or leave him. I mean, I personally think the Velvet Underground were at their best, you know, after John Cale had gone, and when they were doing sort of poppy songs and all the stuff that Lou Reed doesn't like. And I do think Loaded is their best album. Sorry.
It's so subjective, isn't it? It's,
yeah, but there we go.
Points of view are as equally as valid.
No, they're not. I'm right and everyone else is wrong. Sorry, Loaded's got lots of good pop songs on it. There we go. And as far as the Lou Reed thing's concerned, sometimes you think, intense. Sometimes you think, you know, get over yourself. But it's a perfectly good performance. And then at the end, he goes off, he gets an encore, he comes back on. And because he's got this full orchestral backing and these backing singers and this sort of, you know, complicated instrumentation. And then he does, as an encore, he does Candy Says with Anthony from Anthony and the Johnsons. Now, where do you stand on Anthony and the Johnsons?
Respect, it's a little bit different. I don't. Okay. I never took it to my heart, and he's done some interesting vocals for Dance Acts as well in the last year that I have enjoyed. I think just they're so different in the way they approach it that it makes Lou Reed sound so disinterested. But on his own, that's influenced. I mean, one of the best records of this year, The National. What a record that is, and that's so influenced by Lou Reed. So
well, look, I am ambivalent about Lou Reed, but I think if you're a Lou Reed fan, then Lou Reed's Berlin is a good performance film. There are great performance films in the history of, I mean, things like The Last Waltz, which I really love. There's that Neil Young film Heart of Gold, which I saw, which completely changed my mind about Neil Young. I don't think this is going to change anyone's mind about Lou Reed, but I think if you're a Lou Reed fan, you'll feel that you get the album performed properly. It's very, very well orchestrated. It's nicely filmed. There's something slightly po-faced about it, particularly at the beginning when Julian Schnabel comes on and tells everyone to turn off their mobile phones. Mm. You remember that Lou Reed doesn't play rock gigs anymore. He plays sit-down affairs in which people are told that if they talk, Mr. Reed will leave the stage. But, you know, hey, there is stuff to be said in its favour. But I just thought that the combination combination of Andy and Lou singing together on Candy Says, it's worth it just for that.
Now, we'll try and get a word in about Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging, but should we do Before the Rains? Because we had the director of Angus Thongs on earlier in the week. Before the Rains is new territory. Love to hear about it.
Okay, fine. So it's a Merchant Ivory production, although obviously, you know, for obvious reasons, it's neither Merchant nor Ivory that seem to be directly involved. It's directed by the guy who directed The Terrorist back in 1999, and it's actually inspired by one segment of an Israeli drama called Yellow Asphalt, although, of course, the action this time takes place in India. It's a kind of Raj story, and the basic thing is Linus Roach is attempting to build a spice road. He is a married man, but he is also having an affair with a local girl. When the community find out that she is having, well, her husband finds out she's having an affair, she runs off to Linus Roach saying, help me, help me, and he, of course, turns out to be morally ambivalent and complicit. Have we got time to play a clip?
Yeah.
Let's have a listen.
She did not think I would run.
Did he follow you?
No. I went to the river to hide. There was no one there.
Are you certain?
Yes.
This is the first place he will come to look.
He does not know it was you. I protected your name.
Her husband is not the only one you have to worry about. If the council learns of what she has done...
Don't let them take me. They will kill me. In one village, there was a woman. They hanged her by her hair.
That won't happen. I promise you, I won't let it.
Sahib. Sahib, if they find us here, you will not be able to stop them. They will come for her. They will come for you. Even your family will not be safe.
Don't be ridiculous. Don't worry. We'll find somewhere to hide you.
And you will come with me, won't you?
Just rest now.
There you go, clip of Before the Rains.
It's a solid piece of work. I mean, it's, you know, it is in the way of many of those Merchant Ivory productions. It's very beautiful to look at. I mean, it's very, you know, well shot by the director himself, as it turns out. I think what it benefits mainly from is Linus Roach's central performance. Linus Roach is a very interesting actor. Remember, he sort of rose to stardom with Priest. There was a lot of fuss about Priest. He was terrific in Wings of the Dove. Because he's in Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. The thing that he does guilty and conflicted like almost no other British actor. He just has to walk on screen and he just looks guilty and conflicted. And of course, that's what this central role requires from him. It's a good, solid ensemble cast. It's a simple story, well told, 98 minutes, nicely pared down. As I said, originally it was one part of a three-part narrative. I think the only criticism I'd have of it is that, and other people have noted this as well, if it was on the television in the afternoon on a Wednesday, it wouldn't look out of place. I don't know that there's enough in there to get you into the cinema, yeah. Although I have to say, having gone into it with fairly little expectation, I did find it gripping and I thought it was well played and it was a solidly put together drama. It's not much more than that. But in an age in which, you know, so many dramas aren't solidly put together and don't have believable characters and don't actually have a story to tell, it does have all of those things. And the time flew by.
As it has done for your film reviews. So 30 seconds, Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging.
Much better than I'd expected, actually. Yeah. I mean, I think that the thing with it is that after Bend It Like Beckham, that's a very, very high watermark to hit again. But I think its target audience is absolutely 12-year-old girls. It's 12A certificate film, and I think the BBFC have got that exactly right. I don't think you should take anybody much younger than that to go and see it, because obviously it's dealing with adolescent areas. But I think the thing that it has is it has the air of an insider. It's not a children's film, I mean, an adolescent film made patronisingly by an adult. It seems to me that the director has a very, very good sense of her cast and of those issues, and it's very, very even-handed. It's very gentle in its tone. And actually, one of the things that's very funny, I came out of it and there was a group of male film critics outside, and there was a note in the American notes explaining what snogging was.
Yeah.
But there was British film critics standing outside saying, and what exactly is a minga? There's a classic example of, you know, they're just too far out of the ballpark to know.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live